shadow with it. A beep indicated the run was over. Brewer's voice came on the loudspeaker. What in the world were you thinking? Apparently, I dropped way below baseline. I told him in general terms. He sounded excited by the idea that the mere recollection of a psychedelic experience might somehow replicate what happens in the brain during the real thing. Maybe that's what was going on. Or maybe it was the specific content of the image and the mere thought of bidding adieu to my ego, watching it float away like a hot air balloon, that had the power to silence my default mode network. Brewer started spouting hypotheses, which is really all that science can offer us at this point. Hunches, theories, so many more experiments to try. We have plenty of clues, and more now than before the renaissance of psychedelic science, but we remain a long way from understanding exactly what happens to consciousness when we alter it, either with a molecule or with meditation. Yet gazing at the bars on the graph before me, these crude hieroglyphs of psychedelic thought, I felt as if I were standing on the edge of a wide-open frontier, squinting to make out something wondrous. Epilogue. In praise of neural diversity. In April 2017, the International Psychedelic Community gathered in the Oakland Convention Center for Psychedelic Science, an every few years or so event organized by MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, the nonprofit established by Rick Doblin in 1986 with the improbable goal of returning psychedelics to scientific and cultural respectability. In 2016, Doblin himself seemed stunned at how far and fast things had come and how close to hand victory now seemed. Earlier in the year, the FDA had approved phase 3 trials of MDMA, and psilocybin was not far behind. If the results of these trials come anywhere near those of phase 2, the government will presumably have to reschedule the two drugs, and then doctors will be able to prescribe them. "We are not the counterculture," Doblin told a reporter during the conference. "We are the culture." What had been, as recently as 2010, a modest gathering of psychonauts and a handful of renegade researchers was now a 6-day convention come conference that had drawn more than 3,000 people from all over the world to hear researchers from 25 countries present their findings. Not that there weren't also plenty of psychonauts and legions of the psychedelically curious. Between lectures and panels and plenaries, they browsed a sprawling marketplace offering psychedelic books, psychedelic artwork, and psychedelic music. For me, the event turned out to be a kind of reunion, bringing together most of the characters in my story under one roof. I was able to catch up with virtually all the scientists I'd interviewed, though Robin Carhart Harris, with a baby on the way, had to skip, as well as several of the underground guides with whom I'd worked. Everyone, it seemed, was here, scientists rubbing shoulders with guides and shamans, veteran psychonauts, a large contingent of therapists eager to add psychedelics to their practice, plus funders and filmmakers, and even a smattering of entrepreneurs sniffing out business opportunities. And although I picked up snippets of concern about the new Attorney General's efforts to rekindle the drug war, on the whole, the mood was unmistakably celebratory. When I asked conference-goers which session they deemed most memorable, almost invariably they mentioned the plenary panel called Future of Psychedelic Psychiatry. What was most noteworthy about this panel was the identity of the panelists, which, at a psychedelic convention, was cause for cognitive dissonance. Here was Paul Sommergrad, M.D., the former head of the American Psychiatric Association, seated next to Tom Insel, M.D., the former head of the National Institute of Mental Health. The panel was organized and moderated by George Goldsmith, an American entrepreneur and health industry consultant based in London. In the last several years, he and his wife, Ekaterina Malevskaya, a Russian-born physician, have devoted their considerable energy and resources to winning approval for psilocybin-assisted therapy in the European Union. It was clear to everyone in the standing room crowd exactly what the three men on the panel represented, the recognition of psychedelic therapy by the mental health establishment. Insel spoke of how poorly the record of mental health care stacks up against the achievements of the rest of medicine. He He pointed out that it has failed to lower mortality from serious psychiatric disorders and spoke of the promise of new models of mental health treatment, such as psychedelic therapy. "I'm really impressed by the approach here," he told the group. "People don't say simply, 'We're going to give psychedelics.' They talk about psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. I think it's a really novel approach." Insull tempered his enthusiasm, however, by noting that such a novel paradigm may bedevil regulators accustomed to evaluating new drugs in isolation. George Goldsmith asked both men what advice they would give to the researchers in the room, men and women who have been working diligently for years to bring psychedelic therapy to patients. Without hesitating, Insull turned to the audience and said, "Don't screw it up." "There may be lots of promise here," Insull said, "but it's really easy to forget about issues related to safety, issues related to rigor, issues related to reputational risks." He suggested that psychedelics would probably need to be rebranded in the public mind and that it would be essential to steer clear of anything that smacked of recreational use. He and Summergrad both warned that a single sloppy researcher or a patient with a disastrous experience could poison the well for everybody. Nobody needed to mention the name Timothy Leary. How close are we to a world in which psychedelic therapy is sanctioned and routine, and what would such a world look like? Bob Jesse was in the audience when the former head of NIMH took his swipe against recreational use, and though I didn't see it, I can picture his grimace. And what exactly is wrong with recreating ourselves? Bob Jesse worries that the medicalization of psychedelics these men were advocating as the one true path would be a mistake. Not that medicalization will be easy. Several steep regulatory hurdles will first need to be overcome. Phase 3 trials involve multiple sites and hundreds of volunteers. They can cost tens of millions of dollars. Normally, Big Pharma foots the bill for such trials, but thus far the pharmaceutical companies have shown scant interest in psychedelics. For one thing, this class of drugs offers them little, if any, intellectual property. Psilocybin is a product of nature, and the patent on LSD expired decades ago. For another, Big Pharma mostly invests in drugs for chronic conditions, the pills you have to take every day. Why would it invest in a pill patients might only need to take once in a lifetime? Psychiatry faces a similar dilemma. It, too, is wedded to interminable therapies, whether that means the daily antidepressant or the weekly psychotherapy session. It is true that a psychedelic session lasts several hours and usually requires two therapists be present for the duration, but if the therapy works as it's supposed to, there won't be a lot of repeat business. It's not at all clear what the business model might be, yet. Several of the researchers and therapists I've interviewed nevertheless look forward to a time not far off when psychedelic therapy is routine and widely available in the form of a novel hybrid of pharmacology and psychotherapy. George Goldsmith envisions a network of psychedelic treatment centers, facilities in attractive natural settings where patients will go for their guided sessions. He has formed a company called Compass Pathways to build these centers in the belief they can offer a treatment for a range of mental illnesses sufficiently effective and economical that Europe's National Health Service will reimburse for them. Goldsmith has so far raised £3 million to fund and organize psilocybin trials, starting with treatment-resistant depression, at multiple sites in Europe. Already he's working with designers at IDEO, the international design firm, to redesign the entire experience of psychedelic therapy. Paul Summergrad and Tom Insull have both joined his advisory board. Catherine McLean, the former Hopkins researcher who wrote the landmark paper on openness, hopes someday to establish a psychedelic hospice, a retreat center somewhere out in nature where not only the dying but their loved ones can use psychedelics to help them let go. The patient and the loved ones both. "If we limit psychedelics just to the patient," she explains, "we're sticking to the old medical model. But psychedelics are more radical than that. I get nervous when people say they should only be prescribed by a doctor. I imagine a broader application." In McLean's words, it's easy to hear echoes of the 1960s experience with psychedelics, the excitement about their potential to help not only the sick, but everyone else too. This kind of thinking or talking makes some of her mainstream colleagues nervous. It's exactly the kind of talk that Insull and Summergrad were warning the community against. Good luck with that. The betterment of well people is very much on the minds of most of the researchers I interviewed, even if some of them were more reluctant to discuss it on the record than institutional outsiders like Bob Jesse and Rick Doblin and Catherine McLean. For them, medical acceptance is a first step toward a much broader cultural acceptance, outright legalization in Doblin's view, or something more carefully controlled in McLean's and Jesse's. Jesse would like to see the drugs administered by trained guides working in what he calls longitudinal, multigenerational contexts, which, as he describes them, sound a lot like churches. Think of the churches that use ayahuasca in a ritual context, administered by experienced elders in a group setting. Others envision a time when people seeking a psychedelic experience, whether for reasons of mental health or spiritual seeking or simple curiosity, could go very occasionally to something like a mental health club, as Julie Holland, a psychiatrist who used to work with Stephen Ross at Bellevue, described it. Sort of like a cross between a spa retreat and a gym, where people can experience psychedelics in a safe, supportive environment. Or at least people who can afford it. One advantage of medicalizing psychedelic therapy is that it would presumably be accessible to everyone with health insurance. Everyone speaks of the importance of well-trained psychedelic guides, board certified, and the need to help people afterward integrate the powerful experiences they have had in order to make sense of them and render them truly useful. Tony Bosses paraphrases the religious scholar and Good Friday Experiment volunteer Houston Smith on this point. A spiritual experience does not by itself make a spiritual life. Integration is essential to making sense of the experience, whether in or out of the medical context. Or else it remains just a drug experience. As for the guides themselves, they are already being trained and certified. Late in 2016, the California Institute of Integral Studies graduated its first class of 42 psychedelic therapists. This is a development that worries some in the underground who fear being left behind when psychedelic therapy is legitimized. Yet it's hard to imagine such experienced and highly skilled practitioners won't continue to find clients, especially among the well. When I asked Rick Doblin if he worries about another backlash, he pointed out that our culture has come a long way from the 1960s and has shown remarkable ability to digest a great many of the cultural novelties first cooked up during that era. That was a very different time, he says. People wouldn't even talk about cancer or death then. Women were tranquilized to give birth. Men weren't allowed in the delivery room. Yoga and meditation were totally weird. Now, mindfulness is mainstream and everyone does yoga and there are birthing centers and hospices all over. We've integrated all these things into our culture. And now I think we're ready to integrate psychedelics. Doblin points out that many of the people now in charge of our institutions are of a generation well acquainted with these molecules. This, he suggests, is the true legacy of Timothy Leary. It's all well and good for today's researchers to disdain his antics and blame him for derailing the first wave of research, and yet, as Doblin points out with a smile, there would be no second wave if Leary hadn't turned on a whole generation. Indeed, consider the case of Paul Summergrad, who has spoken publicly of his own youthful use of psychedelics. In a videotaped interview with Ram Dass that was shown at the 2015 meeting of the American Psychiatric Association, he told his colleagues that an acid trip he took in college had been formative in his intellectual development. Jeffrey Lieberman, another past president of the American Psychiatric Association, has also written of the insights gleaned from his youthful experiments with LSD. And yet, as much as I want to believe Doblin's sunny forecast, it's not hard to imagine things easily going off the rails. Tony Bosses agrees, as much as he hopes that psychedelics will someday be routine in palliative care. We don't die well in America, he says. Ask people where do you want to die, and they will tell you, at home with their loved ones. But most of us die in an ICU. The biggest taboo in America is the conversation about death. Sure, it's gotten better. Now we have hospices, which didn't exist not so long ago. But to a doctor, it's still an insult to let a patient go. In his view, psychedelics have the potential not only to open up that difficult conversation, but to change the experience of dying itself if the medical community will embrace them. This culture has a fear of death, a fear of transcendence, and a fear of the unknown, all of which are embodied in this work, Bosses points out. Psychedelics may, by their very nature, be too disruptive for our institutions ever to embrace them. Institutions generally like to mediate the individual's access to authority of whatever kind, whether medical or spiritual. Whereas the psychedelic experience offers something akin to direct revelation, making it inherently antinomian. And yet, some cultures have successfully devised ritual forms to contain and harness the Dionysian energies of psychedelics. Think of the Eleusinian mysteries of ancient Greece or the shamanic ceremonies surrounding peyote or ayahuasca in the Americas today. It is not impossible. The first time I raised Jesse's idea of the betterment of well people with Roland Griffiths, he seemed to squirm a bit in his chair and then chose his words with care. Culturally right now, that is a dangerous idea to promote. And yet, as we've talked now over the course of 3 years, it's become clear that he too feels that many of us, and not just those dealing with cancer or depression or addiction, stand to benefit from these remarkable molecules. And even more, from the spiritual experiences to which he believes, indeed his research has demonstrated, they can open a door. We're all dealing with death, as he told me the first time we met. This is far too valuable to limit to sick people. A careful man, mindful of the political landmines that may yet lie ahead, Griffiths amended that last sentence just slightly, recast it in the future tense. This will be far too valuable to limit to sick people. I, for one, sincerely hope that the kinds of experiences I've had on psychedelics will not be limited to sick people and will someday become more widely available. Does that mean I think these drugs should simply be legalized? Not exactly. It is true I had a very positive experience using psilocybin recreationally, on my own, that is, without the support of a guide. And for some people, this might be fine. But sooner or later, it seems, everyone has a trip for which bad is far too pallid a modifier. I would hate to be alone when that happens. For me, working one-on-one with an experienced guide in a safe place removed from my everyday life turned out to be the ideal way to explore psychedelics. Yet there are other ways to structure the psychedelic journey to provide a safe container for its potentially overwhelming energies. Ayahuasca and peyote are typically used in a group, with the leader, often but not necessarily a shaman, acting in a supervisory role in helping people to navigate and interpret their experiences. But whether individually or in a group, the presence of someone with training and experience who can hold the space, to use that hoary New Age locution, is more meaningful and comforting than I would have imagined. Not only did my guides create a setting in which I felt safe enough to surrender to the psychedelic experience, but they also helped me to make sense of it afterward. Just as important, they helped me to see there was something here worth making sense of. This is by no means self-evident. It is all too easy to dismiss what unfolds in our minds during a psychedelic journey as simply a drug experience. And that is precisely what our culture encourages us to do. Matt Johnson made this point the first time we spoke. Let's say you have some 19-year-olds taking mushrooms at a party. One of them has a profound experience. He's come to understand what God is or his connection to the universe. What do his friends say? Oh, man, you had too much last night. No more mushrooms for you. Were you drinking or on drugs is what our culture says when you have a powerful experience. Yet even a moment's reflection tells you that attributing the content of the psychedelic experience to drugs explains virtually nothing about it. The images and the narratives and the insights don't come from nowhere, and they certainly don't come from a chemical. They come from inside our minds, and at the very least have something to tell us about that. If dreams and fantasies and free associations are worth interpreting, then surely so is the more vivid and detailed material with which the psychedelic journey presents us. It opens a new door on one's mind. And about that, my psychedelic journeys have taught me a great many interesting things. Many of these were the kinds of things one might learn in the course of psychotherapy, insights into important relationships, the outlines of fears and desires ordinarily kept out of view, repressed memories and emotions, and perhaps most interesting and useful, a new perspective on how one's mind works. This, I think, is the great value of exploring non-ordinary states of consciousness, the light they reflect back on the ordinary ones, which no longer seem quite so transparent or so ordinary. To realize, as William James concluded, that normal waking consciousness is but one of many potential forms of consciousness, ways of perceiving or constructing the world, separated from it by merely the filmiest of screens, is to recognize that our account of reality, whether inward or outward, is incomplete at best. Normal waking consciousness might seem to offer a faithful map to the territory of reality, and it is good for many things, but it is only a map and not the only map. As to why these other modes of consciousness exist, we can only speculate. Most of the time, it is normal waking consciousness that best serves the interests of survival and is most adaptive. But there are moments in the life of an individual or a community when the imaginative novelties proposed by altered states of consciousness introduce exactly the sort of variation that can send a life or a culture down a new path. For me, the moment I recognized the tenuousness and relativity of my own default consciousness came that afternoon on Fritz's mountaintop when he taught me how to enter a trance state by means of nothing more than a pattern of rapid breathing and the sounds of rhythmic drumming. Where in the world has that been all my life? This is nothing Freud or any number of psychologists and behavioral economists haven't told us, but the idea that normal consciousness is but the tip of a large and largely uncharted psychic iceberg is now for me something more than a theory. The hidden vastness of the mind is a felt reality. I don't mean to suggest I have achieved this state of ego-transcending awareness, only tasted it. These experiences don't last, or at least they didn't for me. After each of my psychedelic sessions came a period of several weeks in which I felt noticeably different, more present to the moment, much less inclined to dwell on what's next. I was also notably more emotional and surprised myself on several occasions by how little it took to make me tear up or smile. I found myself thinking about things like death and time and infinity, but less in angst than in wonder. I spent an unreasonable amount of time reflecting on how improbable and fortunate it is to be living here and now at the frontier of two eternities of non-existence. All at once and unexpectedly, waves of compassion or wonder or pity would wash over me. This was a way of being I treasured, but alas, every time it eventually faded. It's difficult not to slip back into the familiar grooves of mental habit. They are so well worn. The tidal pull of what the Buddhists call our habit energies is difficult to withstand. Add to this the expectations of other people, which subtly enforce a certain way of being yourself, no matter how much you might want to attempt another. After a month or so, it was pretty much back to baseline. But not quite, not completely. For much like the depressed patients I interviewed in London who described being nourished and even inspired by their furloughs from the cage of depression, the experience of some other way of being in the world survives in memory as a possibility and a destination. For me, the psychedelic experience opened a door to a specific mode of consciousness that I can now occasionally recapture in meditation. I'm speaking of a certain cognitive space that opens up late in a trip or in the midst of a mild one, a space where you can entertain all sorts of thoughts and scenarios without reaching for any kind of resolution. It somewhat resembles hypnagogic consciousness, that liminal state perched on the edge of sleep when all kinds of images and scraps of story briefly surface before floating away. But this is sustained, and what comes up can be clearly recalled. And though the images and ideas that appear are not under your direct control, but rather seem to be arriving and departing of their own accord, you can launch a topic or change it like a channel. The ego is not entirely absent. You haven't been blasted into particles or have returned from that particular state, but the stream of consciousness is taking its own desultory course, and you are bobbing and drifting along with it, looking neither forward nor back, immersed in the currents of being rather than doing. And yet a certain kind of mental work is getting done, and occasionally I have emerged from the state with usable ideas, images, or metaphors. My psychedelic adventures familiarized me with this mental territory, and sometimes, not always, I find I can return to it during my daily meditation. I don't know if this is exactly where I'm supposed to be when I'm meditating, but I'm always happy to find myself floating in this particular mental stream. I would never have found it if not for psychedelics. This strikes me as one of the great gifts of the experience they afford, the expansion of one's repertoire of conscious states. Just because the psychedelic journey takes place entirely in one's mind doesn't mean it isn't real. It is an experience, and for some of us, one of the most profound a person can have. As such, it takes its place as a feature in the landscape of a life. It can serve as a reference point, a guidepost, a wellspring, and for some, a kind of spiritual sign or shrine. For me, the experiences have become landmarks to circle around and interrogate for meaning. Meanings about myself, obviously, but also about the world. Several of the images that appeared in the course of my trips I think about all the time, hoping to unwrap what feels like a gift of meaning, from where or what or whom I cannot say. There was that steel pylon hovering over the landscape of self, or the image of my grandfather's skull staring back at me in Mary's mirror. The majestic but now hollowed-out trees in which my parents appeared to me, liable to topple in the next windstorm. Or the inky well of Yo-Yo Ma's cello, resonating with Bach's warm embrace of death. But there is one other image I haven't shared that I keep thinking must contain some important teaching, even as it continues to mystify me. My last psychedelic journey was on ayahuasca. I was invited to join a circle of women who gather every 3 or 4 months to work with a legendary guide, a woman in her 80s who had trained under Leo Zeff. She, in turn, had trained Mary, the woman who guided my psilocybin journey. This journey was different from the others in that it took place in the company of a dozen other travelers, all of them strangers to me. Befitting this particular psychedelic, which is a tea brewed from 2 Amazonian plants, one a vine, the other a leaf, there was a considerable amount of ceremony in the shamanic mode, the singing of traditional ikaros, prayers and invocations to the grandmother, aka the plant teacher or ayahuasca, bells and rattles and shakapas, and the blowing on us of various scents and smokes. All of which contributed to a mood of deep mystery and a suspension of disbelief that was especially welcome, inasmuch as we were in a yoga studio a long way from any jungle. As has been the case with all of my journeys, the night before had been sleepless, as part of me worked to convince the rest of me not to do this crazy thing. That part was, of course, my ego, which before every trip has fought the threat to its integrity with ferocity and ingenuity, planting doubts and scenarios of disaster I had trouble batting away. What about your heart, pal? You could die. What if you lose your lunch or, even worse, your shit? And what if the grandmother dredges up some childhood trauma? Do you really want to lose it among these strangers? These women? Part of the power of the ego flows from its command of one's rational faculties. By the time I arrived for the circle, I was a nervous wreck, assailed by second and third thoughts as to the wisdom of what I was about to do. But, as has happened every time, as soon as I swallowed the medicine and slipped past the point of no return, the voice of doubt went quiet and I surrendered to whatever was in store. Which was not unlike my other psychedelic experiences, with a couple of notable exceptions. Perhaps because the tea, which was viscous and acrid and unexpectedly sweet, makes its alien presence felt in your stomach and intestines, ayahuasca is a more bodily experience than some other psychedelics. I did not get sick, but but I was very much aware of the thick brew moving through me, and as the effect of the DMT, ayahuasca's active ingredient, came on, imagined it as a vine winding its way through the curls and convolutions of my intestines, occupying my body before slowly working its snake-like way up to and into my head. There followed a great many memories and images, some horrifying, others magnificent, but I want to describe one in particular because, although I don't completely understand it, it captures something that psychedelics have taught me, something important. Because there was still some light in the room when the ceremony began, we were all wearing eye masks, and mine felt a little tight around my head. Early in the journey, I became aware of the black straps circling my skull, and these morphed into bars. My head was caged in steel. The bars then began to multiply, moving down from my head to encircle my torso and then my legs. I was now trapped head to toe in a black steel cage. I pressed against the bars, but they were unyielding. There was no way out. Panic was building. When I noticed the green tip of a vine at the base of the cage, it was growing steadily upward and then turning sinuously to slip out between two of the bars, freeing itself and at the same time reaching toward the light. A plant can't be caged, I heard myself thinking. Only an animal can be caged. I can't tell you what this means, if anything. Was the plant showing me a way out? Perhaps, but it's not as if I could actually follow it. I am an animal, after all. Yet it seemed the plant was trying to teach me something, that it was proposing a kind of visual koan for me to unpack, and I have been turning it over in my mind ever since. Maybe it was a lesson about the folly of approaching an obstacle head-on, that sometimes the answer is not the application of force, but rather changing the terms of the problem in such a way that it loses its dominion without actually crumbling. It felt like some kind of jiu-jitsu, because the vine wasn't just escaping the confines of the cage, it was using the structure to improve its situation, climbing higher to gather more light for itself. Or maybe the lesson was more universal, something about plants themselves and how we underestimate them. My plant teacher, as I began to think of the vine, was trying to tell me something about itself and the green kingdom it represents, a kingdom that has always figured largely in my work and my imagination. That plants are intelligent, I have believed for a long time, not necessarily in the way we think of intelligence, but in a way appropriate to themselves. We can do many things plants can't, yet they can do all sorts of things we can't, escaping from steel cages, for example, or eating sunlight. If you define intelligence as the ability to solve the novel problems reality throws at the living, plants surely have it. They also possess agency and awareness of their environment and a kind of subjectivity, a set of interests they pursue, and so a point of view. But though these are all ideas I have long believed and am happy to defend, never before have I felt them to be true, to be as deeply rooted as I did after my psychedelic journeys. The uncageable vine reminded me of that first psilocybin trip when I felt the leaves and plants in the garden returning my gaze. One of the gifts of psychedelics is the way they reanimate the world, as if they were distributing the blessings of consciousness more widely and evenly over the landscape, in the process breaking the human monopoly on subjectivity that we moderns take as a given. To us, we are the world's only conscious subjects, with the rest of creation made up of objects. To the more egotistical among us, even other people count as objects. Psychedelic consciousness overturns that view by granting us a wider, more generous lens through which we can glimpse the subjecthood, the spirit, of everything, animal, vegetable, even mineral, all of it now somehow returning our gaze. Spirits, it seems, are everywhere. New rays of relation appear between us and all the world's others. Even in the case of the minerals, modern physics, forget psychedelics, gives us reason to wonder if perhaps some form of consciousness might not figure in the construction of reality. Quantum mechanics holds that matter may not be as innocent of mind as the materialist would have us believe. For example, a subatomic particle can exist simultaneously in multiple locations, is pure possibility until it is measured, that is, perceived by a mind, Only then, and not a moment sooner, does it drop into reality as we know it, acquire fixed coordinates in time and space. The implication here is that matter might not exist as such in the absence of a perceiving subject. Needless to say, this raises some tricky questions for a materialist understanding of consciousness. The ground underfoot may be much less solid than we think. This is the view of quantum physics, not some psychonaut, though it is a very psychedelic theory. I mention it only because it lends some of the authority of science to speculations that would otherwise sound utterly lunatic. I still tend to think that consciousness must be confined to brains, but I am less certain of this belief now than I was before I embarked on this journey. Maybe it, too, has slipped out from between the bars of that cage. Mysteries abide. But this I can say with certainty. The mind is vaster and the world ever so much more alive than I knew when I began. This is Michael Pollan. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. This program was directed by Mary Diltz. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Text, copyright 2018 by Michael Pollan. Production, copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.